Okay, Mr. Zivitz.
Hello, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Andrew Zivitz, on behalf of the plaintiffs and appellants. Your Honor, the issue here is the same that existed in Leidas, whether or not this complaint can sound in fraud when there's nothing on the face of the complaint that says fraud, says anything associated with fraud, discusses knowledge, discusses intent, discusses concealment, anything of that nature.
One difference, certainly, between the two is that in this case, there, in round one, were allegations of 10b-5 violation. Round two dropped those allegations. But the district court, Judge Mossman, basically said, look, it's the same thing. So fraud is fraud, and in the second round, sounds and fraud as well. What is your response on that?
Several things, Your Honor. First of all, there are many cases where this has happened before, DDI being one, BioLase being another, both out of the Central District of California, where there were Exchange Act claims and Securities Act claims pled together. The Exchange Act claims were taken out the second time around, and the Securities Act claims were held to pass muster under Rule 8A. So there is precedent for this, obviously. As far as Judge Mossman's decision, I would respectfully say that from the oral argument transcript, he came out of the box with a tentative ruling saying that this complaint
But the time he was through with it, he gave a different one. So it's the one at the end of the day that counts.
Yes, and no question, Your Honor. And I think that was because defendants did an excellent job at oral argument raising Leidas. The district court, from a close read of the transcript, gives its tentative ruling that this clearly sounds in negligence, says that there's two scenarios in which the sounds and fraud doctrine can require 9b to apply to a complaint, and those situations don't apply here, then defendants raise Leidas as a third scenario, the third scenario being what we just discussed. If there's something that's important to the company, management must have known about it, and management must have known that the prospectus was false and misleading, and management must have fraudulently intended to issue that registration statement and prospectus with fraudulent intent. So I think the court recognized at the beginning that the state of the case law was such that this case does not sound in fraud, but was brought back around with the discussion.
Okay, well, let me go back and try to focus on the point that I wanted to really hear you on, and that is that the district court said that the substance of the alleged misrepresentations or omissions that form the basis of your 10b-5 claim also form the basis of your remaining claims.
The first time around. Okay.
Yeah, but here's the crucial point. I understand it was round one and round two. I get that. But he said the substance of the claims were the same. And if that's true, it doesn't matter whether it was round one versus round two. He's saying the substance of the claims was the same. That is, they sounded in fraud.
The substance of the claims are not the same. When we repled this case, we repled the allegations in negligence and innocence. Remember, negligence is a lesser form of fraud.
Yeah.
So now we're not alleging that they did anything improper as we did with the first time around. The complaint was stripped down. It's now just a negligence and innocent conduct complaint. And I might bring to the Court's attention the case that defendants recently filed, I think, on Wednesday, submitted to the Court on Wednesday, which states that you can have conflicting views in concurrent complaints. It doesn't render the second complaint a sham pleading, as this Court, I think Judge Kaczynski, held in the PEA case. I think it's difficult to see from this record what exactly Judge Mossman did, because he issued a two-page order referring back to the transcript from below. But at the transcript below, he recognized that from the face of this pleading, it's certainly plausible that some of the things that we alleged were the result of negligent conduct. For example, we allege that the company sent out defective goods unintentionally, innocently. The court said, isn't it possible to defendants that it was done out of, you know, inadvertence, innocence, and defendants conceded it's definitely conceivable. So the judge relies on that record when he issues its two-page order.
Well, you know, I don't want to quibble with you. I think in fairness to the district judge, we all say an awful lot of things during the course of an argument. What matters is his ruling.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave about a two-page ruling orally, said he would go line by line, which he did, and he came out with a conclusion. And that differed in some respects from his tentative ruling, but so what?
Oh.
I mean, the real question, and the real thing is his ultimate decision. And why is it that it's incorrect? If the same allegations sound in fraud for one purpose, don't they sound in fraud for all purposes?
And the answer, I would say, is no.
And
because as pled, the new allegations do not sound in fraud.
Yeah, okay.
The intent has been pulled out of the complaint. I'll direct the court to the DDI case out of the Central District. I think Judge Minella did a wonderful job there saying that the theory of intent can change from complaint to complaint. Negligence is clearly a lesser form of intent than fraud. If you plead fraud in one case, you realize that fraud didn't take place, you can ratchet it back to negligence. So that's clear. The judge, touching on the order, the judge, some things you can read into the order is the judge did not find that there was a uniform course of fraudulent conduct alleged here because he claimed to have stripped away the fraud allegations. Now, we're at a loss as to exactly what allegations he found to sound in fraud versus those allegations sounded in negligence.
Do you agree with his assessment, I think it was his, that this thing really turns on four things: exaggerated customer demand, overstated earnings, overly optimistic statements about the Wood Village facility. Actually, that's only three things.
I would say yes, four categories. I would describe them a bit differently, but yes.
Okay, so how is it, in your view, that the company could have negligently misrepresented its earnings?
Because
how is it that the company could have negligently misrepresented when the Wood Village facility opened and what its effect was? I mean, how do you get negligence out of those difficulties?
With respect to the revenue recognition, the issue is, did the company inadvertently or innocently ship out defective goods? That's our allegation. If, in fact, that was the case, we allege that it was roughly 15% of all PCBs, printed circuit boards, that were...
Okay.
That
and your point is it could have... I mean, the quality assurance that it didn't put in place was negligence.
Correct. Well, it's not so much that they didn't put it in place, because that's an affirmative act.
Or that they, when they didn't say it, they didn't disclose it, it was negligence. Which is it? I mean, it can be two different things.
Well, let me back up.
So I mean, I'm sure the company's not going to say that it intentionally sent out defective products. I mean, you know. But the issue here is not the fact that the defective products existed, but rather whether they failed to disclose it. And you're saying they failed to disclose it negligently?
Absolutely. Because
they just didn't think they had to disclose it? Or they made sort of a malpractice call? I don't understand that.
Our allegation is that on the highest level of the company, when they issued this prospectus, they said, we comply with certain quality assurance controls. We manufacture PCBs according to client specifications. Our allegation is that the state of affairs at that time was such that the company, on the lowest levels, was not following it. Now, we don't allege that the lowest levels of the company were not following those controls purposely or intentionally. They just didn't do it. Maybe they were rushing to get the boards out of the shop. Maybe they were lazy. It just so happens that the company, again, on the lowest levels, was not following the quality assurance controls that they represented they were in the IPO prospectus. And that absolutely can be done innocently. And Judge Mossman recognized that at oral argument. Now, did you want to add something?
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, just what's the next step? So their failure to disclose it is negligent because...
It renders the statements in the prospectus false, misleading, and it omits to disclose the fact that 15% of the boards were being shipped out in a defective state. And that's where the revenue allegation comes from.
But how do you do that negligently?
They didn't know.
They just didn't disclose. Oh, they didn't know it.
They didn't know. They failed to investigate.
They failed to investigate. They didn't reasonably investigate. From the face of our pleading suggests they didn't know what was going on with respect to quality assurance and quality control. Now, I know defendants are going to get up and they're going to say this was something that was so important to the company, we must have known about it. But again, you get into that difficult area of, well, is this something that crosses that materiality threshold where management must have known about it? But that would, again, cause all Section 11 claims to sound in fraud. As far as the other allegations are concerned, and now it seems we're getting a bit into the falsity issue, but as far as decreasing demand and decreasing customer contraction, allegations like that, virtually identical, survived in other cases such as DDI and Kensington, BioLase, Suprema out of the Third Circuit. The issue is what, from the face of this complaint, is alleged as to knowledge and concealment and fraudulent intent. And I respectfully submit there is nothing on the face of this complaint that suggests defendants did anything along those lines. Everything was done innocently, negligently, as Judge Paez said, with a failure to reasonably investigate what was the true state of affairs then existing at the company. Again, getting back to some of the issues before the district court found that the defective product issue was certainly something that was conceivably missed by upper management. So again, what was in the record before does not necessarily support the judge's order. Let me reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Sure. Surely.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm Ron Berenstain for the Merricks defendants, and with my counsel for the underwriters, we're going to split our time. I'm mainly going to discuss the subject that has been now discussed for quite some time, which is the issue of whether or not this complaint should have been dismissed for failure to plead fraud with specificity, and my counsel for the underwriters will address a separate ground to affirm Judge Mossman's decision, and that's that even if you look at all the allegations of the complaint, they don't state anything in the prospectus, which is in fact taken as a whole, not true. With respect to what happened in this case, as Your Honors have observed, this started out as a combination 10b-5 and Section 11 case. Judge Mossman concluded in dismissing the first amended complaint, he found a unified course of fraudulent conduct, more like the stack type of analysis, the same allegations that were pled throughout the period, whether it was pre the prospectus, it was after the prospectus, and it was during the prospectus, he found that it was a unified course of fraudulent conduct. 9B had to apply to the Section 11 claims, therefore, and they failed to plead that with specificity. What did the plaintiffs do? They then abandoned, instead of what we expected, which was to try to come up with some more detail, they abandoned all pretext of detail and tried to plead a Section 11 case only. It is noteworthy here that unlike Lita's case, what Judge Mossman did in this case, in the Merricks case, is he gave plaintiffs every benefit of the doubt when it came to looking at the Section 11 allegation standing alone. And he said, I'm going to do what Vest says I should do. I'm not saying that there's a unified course of fraudulent conduct. I'm not saying that the gravamen of the complaint is fraud. I'm going to go by allegation. I'm going to do a 9B averment by averment under the old words, now allegation by allegation under the new
word. One of the problem, of course, is that we don't know which ones he picked out. He just concluded. I'm not saying that's anything wrong with it. It just means I don't know why he concluded what he did.
Your Honor, I think if you read, as Your Honor has, the entire colloquy at the oral argument, he said exactly what he was going to do, and he said, I'm going to follow the law of this circuit, which Vest tells me to do. If there's allegations of fraud,
okay, perhaps I was being too obscure. I mean, he didn't say why he ended up, after having gone through line by line, he concluded that that the complaint was any different from the first one. So I guess to be more specific, with respect to these particular discrete issues, whether Cisco was still a customer, whether Wood Village was up and running, and whether you exaggerated returns, why is it that you think that's only that has to be fraud and isn't true, is not susceptible plausibly of being a negligence claim?
Well, first, Your Honor, I think we start with looking at the allegation of negligence, which plaintiffs put in their complaint. It's a simple and totally speculative assertion that the defendants failed to make a reasonable investigation or did not possess reasonable grounds for believing the statements in the prospectus were true. That's all that it is, Your Honor. It doesn't come with any kind of detail. It's pure conclusion. It's an assertion of negligence without any detail as to what the basis for the negligence is. And therefore, Judge Mossman was left with, okay, I have to decide, is this plausibly negligence or more plausibly fraud? It's not a question of whether or not it could be negligence. The question is whether or not it is plausibly negligence or more plausibly fraud.
I understand that that's the question. My question is, why is it that the discrete allegations that are made are not plausibly capable of being read as negligence?
Look at the nature and the number of the allegations in this complaint, which I think is what Judge Mossman did. And Your Honor is correct. He was likely influenced by what had been done in the First Amendment complaint. He rejected our argument, however, that it seemed to reject it, that the plaintiffs couldn't take positions that were completely that they could take positions completely contrary to what they alleged in their First Amendment complaint. We had argued that those were judicial admissions, and they couldn't now say that somebody didn't know when you said they did know. But he went through. He looked at the nature and the number of the allegations that plaintiffs alleged, the omissions and misrepresentations, took them. And as Your Honor has said, you're talking about a cataclysmic decline in the customer base of this company. You're talking about a prospectus that came out in January 2004. They alleged that in October or November or December, there was a cataclysmic decline in customer base so that, for instance, Cisco, they only had two customers that accounted for more than 10% of the business. This customer was completely off the map before the prospectus came out, completely off the map, went from being the first or second customer to not even being in the top 25. The judge looked at that and said, it's not plausible that the writers of this prospectus, these professionals working on this prospectus, the defendants, the underwriters working on this prospectus, could possibly miss the fact. Could possibly. It's not reasonable. It's pure speculation. You could say it's negligence, but the only thing that's plausible is that they certainly would have noticed that the number one customer at this company was no longer in the top 25. And the same with respect to every single one of the other ones. They talk about the huge decline in the orders. They were putting out 100 to 200 flats per order. This is their allegation. It went from 4 to 5 flats per order. This is taking place in one factory. They're sending home workers. They're alleging they're sending home workers. I think the only way to look at that is cataclysmic. And then of course, you add the allegations with respect to the so-called product defect. They're saying that 15% of the products that were going out, as much as 15%, were defective, so much so that another one of their main customers, Motorola, had rejected an entire order, and that the customer relations with Motorola and other key customers were so bad that it was affecting this company's business. Now, is it plausible that those kind of things could be taking place at a company this size with one factory in a couple-month period before the prospectus was issued, and the writers of the prospectus At a minimum, Your Honor, it would be reckless, which is the same standard. That is fraud. It is not plausible that it could just be the result of something that the writer of the prospectus missed. And these people don't even allege. They don't allege how it was negligent. They don't allege how somebody missed something like this. That's the route that Judge Mossman followed in doing his analysis. We've heard, Your Honor, about a number of these state court, I mean the district court cases from other districts. The counsel has mentioned them a number of times, both in the previous argument, this argument, such as DDI and Touchstone and Kensington and JDS Uniphase, where in fact courts have concluded that Section 11 and 12 claims do not sound in fraud. Most of the time, these cases don't exactly tell us where the reasoning came from. And we also, of course, have the Suprema case from another circuit. But all of these cases, I think, Your Honor, can be explained in a way that the judges were looking for some mechanistic, formulaic approach rather than doing the hard work, the legal analysis, that is required by Stack, by Vess, and now particularly by Trombley. And all of those cases are pre-Trombley cases. And in most of those cases, Your Honor, they have exactly the same allegations of negligence, the same allegation of just this failure to investigate. And if you listen to the words of Trombley, it says a plaintiff's obligation is to provide grounds for his entitlement to relief, which requires more than labels and conclusions and formulaic recitations of the elements of the action. That's what all of those cases stand for, and that's the position that the appellants are taking here. They say all you've got to do is assert negligence, failure to investigate, and the ball game is over. And that's what those judges, in every one of those cases I just identified, I think that's exactly what they did. They said, there's words of negligence here. As Judge Paya said, you don't have to, in a Section 11 case, you don't have to allege negligence. In all these cases, including the one we have here, they do allege negligence. And it's just the formulaic, mechanistic assertion of negligence, which Trombley now tells us, those kinds of boilerplate assertions of negligent investigation or negligence diligence is just simply the boilerplate. It's not adequate, and the judge's obligation is to engage in the gatekeeper function, which Judge Nelson recognized as far back as Stack, and decide whether or not, is it plausible that this is really negligent? Not that it's theoretical negligence. That's what DDI does. That's what Uniphase does. That's what Touchstone does. They just say theoretically it could be negligence. That's just as bad as the cases that allow a plaintiff to disclaim fraud, saying if you take out the fraud words, you naysay fraud. As long as you don't have any fraud language, then it's okay. Those cases all stand for that proposition. You can't look for certain words. You can't rely on simply assertions of negligence.
Mr. Bornstein, I don't know how much time you wanted to leave for your co-counsel, but
he has. Let me just wrap up, and I'll give him some time. One of the things that the appellant's claim is that there's some kind of hocus pocus that went on in this case or these other cases that the judge, in this case Judge Mossman, looked behind things, was reading between the lines, was looking into the heads of what the plaintiffs were alleging or what the underwriters or the other defendants knew. That isn't what goes on here. This is just the kind of legal analysis. It's not mystical. It's pure legal analysis that the district judge is required to do. This is exactly what this circuit has been emphasizing and requiring. This is simply another form of artful pleading. The sounds and fraud concept clearly falls within that same construct as artful pleading. And the courts in this circuit simply do not allow put form over substance and don't allow a plaintiff to plead around a pleading requirement. With respect to the differences between the defendants, let me just comment on that to address a question that Your Honor had in the last group. In this case, there is no differences in the way that the court and the way the plaintiffs made their allegations with respect to the underwriters or the other defendants. They treated them all the same. Absolutely no difference whatsoever. The first time that this whole issue of the potential difference between underwriters and the other defendants came up was at oral argument and now in the briefs. So number one, they should be required to stick to their allegations. Their allegations don't address any differences with respect to the alleged conduct, whether it's, they call it negligence, we call it fraud. And number two is, again, given the nature and the number of the kind of assertions, the kinds of allegations here, there would be absolutely no difference. There's no reason to believe, it's not plausible to believe, that the underwriters who were here working, doing the same things, getting ready for this prospectus, could possibly have missed and not seen the kind of cataclysmic event.
I can easily see why the underwriters could be negligent in not following up on stuff where the company would just be plain stupid.
Again,
I mean, there is a difference, and that was the heart of my question in the last case. I don't think it works just to say that there is no difference. I mean, underwriters are differently situated from the management of a company.
There is a difference, possibly, yes. Theoretically, obviously, Your Honor, there is a difference, and there could be differences. And if those differences had been alleged, it would be a difference.
Okay, I hear that. And, I mean, we know what the complaint is. Are you going to give any time to counsel?
Yes, I'm going to give him the rest of the time.
Okay.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Darrell Liu for the underwriter defendants. Let me just pick up on one thing plaintiff's counsel said about quality control and this theory that these issues of defect were limited to the shop floor. That's not what the complaint says. They made the same argument before Judge Mossman that this was a shop floor issue. But in fact, the allegations related to defect and revenue decline as a result of defects in the complaint at the record at 53 say that they caused impairment of customer relations, business problems. Those issues about impairment of business relations and problems with major customers are not relegated to the guys working the presses. Those are top-level issues that come to the attention both of management and in due diligence to the underwriters. You know, this company had five major customers, and it's not going to escape notice that the major customer, one of the two major customers, just fell off the face of the earth in the several months leading up to the prospectus. That's not, you could, the allegation, if believed, is more than mere negligence. It's at a minimum reckless. And so this notion that this is a shop floor issue, these things are secreted in the basement of this company, is not borne out by the allegations of the complaint or by common sense. With respect to the issue of the underwriters, I will also say that there isn't a basis in the complaint. All the defendants are lumped together. As you said, it's one ball of wax here. There's no effort made to distinguish between the knowledge or conduct of the different defendant groups with respect to putting together this prospectus. The Rombach case, on which plaintiffs rely from the Second Circuit, had allegations in that complaint of negligence against the underwriters and fraud and negligence against the insiders. And so there was a clear distinction in the complaints itself between knowledge and conduct of the defendant groups. That's not what's going on here. Now, let me address, in the time I have left, an alternative ground to affirm this judgment below. And that is that even if you believe the allegations of the second amended complaint, if you measure those allegations against the actual language of this prospectus, the prospectus is not false or misleading. And it's telling that the plaintiff didn't even put in the record the prospectus, because if you lay the prospectus down and look next to it at the allegations of the second amended complaint that are well pleaded, The allegations don't render the prospectus false. Let me just start off by noting risk disclosures. This case is in the heartland of cases like Stack, Convergent Technologies, and the District Court, Chang V. Moon. There are 9 pages of risk disclosures here, making up about 25% of this prospectus. They address the very issues that arose 4 months after the prospectus was released that ultimately triggered this lawsuit. The principal one being a decrease in demand.
And if you look at the prospectus, not only is there a multitude of warnings and red flags and risks about the dangers of decreased demand, but in noting the risk, they also note the reality, and they say as follows. We have experienced terminations, reductions, and delays in our customers' orders. They say that. So this isn't something that was being hidden. The prospectus says we have experienced terminations, reductions, and delays. And they further warn that further terminations, reductions, or delays could negatively affect our business. And that is sufficient. It fairly overflows. It discloses what they say was omitted, and it's surrounded by ample cautionary language so that no reasonable investor in this case could have been misled on this prospectus about the nature of an investment in Merix. And I think STAC is a sufficient basis to affirm under Rule 8. Now, secondly, let me just take one of the specific allegations. Let's take Cisco. Okay, the prospectus says that Cisco, in prior historical periods, up through November 03, was in the top 25 and top 5 original equipment customers. That's it. There's no current statement in the prospectus about the status of Cisco, about orders from Cisco. It's a historical statement. What the second amended complaint alleges is that because of alleged declines in orders in October 03, November 03, because of declines in orders, at the time of the offering, so in January, Cisco was no longer a top 25 or top 5 customer of Merix. Now, there is nothing in the prospectus that says that that, in fact, is the case. The statements in the prospectus are historical. The second amended complaint does not challenge those historical statements. And even if it did, it wouldn't be plausible that Merix's customer, Cisco, fell from the top 25 to zero. Furthermore, under this court's decision in Verifone, an accurate historical listing of a customer among a list of customers, even prominent customers, does not imply an existing status or number of orders at the time the prospectus is issued. And that's just an example. I urge you to look at each allegation and measure it against the prospectus, and I think that Rule 8 supplies an alternative ground to affirm this, as well as, of course, the fact that the complaint sounds in fraud. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Liu. Mr. Zivit.
Hello again, Your Honors. A few points, just touching on Mr. Liu's comments. We allege, with respect to the historical statements about customer demand and customer orders that are referenced in the complaint, that they had dropped. The historical statements, we allege, were false and misleading. So I think that's just to touch on that point. As far as the risk disclosures are concerned, risk disclosures have teeth with respect to forward-looking statements. You can risk away forward-looking statements such as I expect, we believe, we forecast. We're alleging that historical statements and present tense statements were false and misleading. So I don't believe that the risk disclosure, I mean, that risk, you can't risk away strict liability. If the statements in your prospectus are materially false and misleading or omit to disclose material facts, they're false and misleading for purposes of Section 11, you're strictly liable for them. Now, of course, there's the due diligence defense that applies to the underwriters and management that can come up in the course of discovery or after discovery, but at the pleading stage, the issue is the issuer and everybody else is strictly liable on the face of the pleadings. Now, I keep coming back to the issue of, with respect to the, you know, the quote-unquote allegations of fraud, I still haven't been able to identify what the allegations of fraud are. All of the cases, and let me, I can't emphasize this enough, no case has ever held as Letus has held and as Merix has held. The issue is, what do the allegations say? No decision has ever said, well, a plaintiff's alleged this, but we're going to say that it really resulted from this, because that's what's happening here. They're saying that Cisco dropped orders. There's no way the company couldn't have known about that. That's not what we pled. What we pled is that Cisco's orders dropped. That was a material misleading statement from the prospectus, and there wasn't a reasonable investigation conducted to assess that. That's negligence. From the face of the pleading, that stands. As far as the factual issue, let me just say that that gets us away from the decision of the district court. The decision of the district court, of course, is, did this complaint sound in fraud? It found that it did. Didn't go into the Rule 8A inquiry. While this court's decision
is done de novo, so of course you can consider the Rule 8A inquiry. We've already discussed, one, the defect issue. That clearly is plausible under a Rule 8A inquiry. It's plausible, it's certainly possible, if not likely, that management didn't know things were being shipped out in a defective state. That passes muster under Rule 8A. Same thing with increasing or decreasing demand. If demand was decreasing leading up to the state of, or to the IPO, the state of affairs was that, and it's plausible, if not possible and likely, that defendants didn't know about it. So again, to read past the allegations in our complaint, I don't believe that that passes muster under Rule 8A. As far as defendant's point that the extent of the misstatement somehow causes this complaint to sound in fraud, defendants raised the issue that there were 48 false and misleading statements. Let me just emphasize that a registration statement contains thousands of statements. To say that 48 statements somehow causes a huge document like that to sound in fraud is a bit of an overstatement. The other issue is that, as Your Honor brought up initially, there were essentially four issues at play here, and there happened to be a fair amount of false and misleading statements that dealt with those four issues. But to say that management must have known of all of those issues because there were 48 misstatements in the registration statement is, again, a bit of an overstatement, and again gets to the nub of the issue, which is how many misstatements must there be for the court to be in a position to say, you know what, they must have known about it. Where do we draw the line? Is it 48? Is it 100? Is it 148? So I think that's a key issue to take note of as well. I don't have anything further if the court doesn't have any questions.
Okay, I don't think so.
Thank you.
We hear a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your endurance and for your arguments. The matter just argued will be submitted, and the court will stand adjourned.